Back in December of 1980, an extraordinary series of UFO incidents took place in Rendlesham Forest in the United Kingdom. What you are about to hear is the inside story of the world's best documented UFO incident. Nick Pope joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. Encounter in the Rendlesham Forest, an incredible story, the inside story of the world's best documented UFO incident, and you thought Roswell was. Nick Pope, of course, a regular here on Coast to Coast AM, was an official at the UK's Ministry of Defense. That was from 1985 to 2006. He was also the desk officer responsible for investigating officially documented UFO sightings to determine whether they involved any potential threat to the UK. And Nick and his colleagues became privately convinced that there were important defense, national security, and flight safety issues involved in the unexplained phenomena. Nick now works as a broadcaster, journalist, covering subjects about the unexplained, and he has written this book with John Burroughs and Jim Peniston, both retired United States Air Force members. You may remember their names when Linda Moulton Howe has been on the program with us. She's going to pop in a half hour or so and talk with Nick as well about this incredible case. Nick, this is one, a great book, but what an incredible story, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. I have made no bones about saying that I think this case in many ways is bigger and more important than Roswell. And by that, I don't mean to disparage any of the witnesses or researchers into that case. It's simply that this is more recent and pretty much all the witnesses are still alive and talking, whereas with Roswell, of course, pretty much all the primary witnesses have now passed. So, of course, this UFO incident is much easier for people to really get into.
Nick, give us an overview of this incredible case over this three-day span. What happened?
Well, as you say, this was 3 days, and that in itself is remarkable. It's December 1980, the height of the Cold War, and it all takes place in Rendlesham Forest, which lies between two military bases in England, Bentwaters and Woodbridge. Now, although they're in England, they are operated by the United States Air Force. And on the first night, in the early hours of December 26th, guard personnel see strange lights in the forest, and they think that maybe a small aircraft has crashed and started a fire. It's very unusual colors, effects. They think it's very weird. They go out there, and as they're going out there, one of them says, "Hey, it didn't crash, it landed." And obviously they're very disconcerted by this. John Burroughs and Jim Peniston are the two that go furthest forward. There are all sorts of radio problems that cause other personnel to be left back. And they, to cut a long story short, don't find a crashed aircraft. They find a landed UFO. Strange symbols on the side of this thing, a bit like Egyptian hieroglyphs. They take loads of photos, but subsequently they're told they didn't come out. After about 45 minutes, maybe, the UFO slowly, and this thing is about 9 feet by 9 feet, broadly triangular, looks a bit like a lunar landing module, that sort of thing. It slowly takes off, clears the tree canopy, and then shoots off to the horizon. And Jim Peniston wrote in his police notebook, "Speed impossible." Now, the UFO returned on the subsequent night. There were blue balls of light passing through the open window of a Jeep. Somebody was so spooked they had to be taken off duty. All sorts of military witnesses encountering strange things. And then on the third night, the deputy base commander, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Holt, is told that this UFO has returned. He goes out into the forest to debunk it, in his own words, and he kind of effectively ends up right in the middle of a UFO encounter himself, and this craft is performing incredible speeds in the sky, tracking backwards and forwards as if it's doing a grid search. And at one point, it fires a beam of light down at him and his men, and he says, "Is this a weapon? Is this a warning? Is this communication? What is this?
What is it, yeah?"
And that, in a nutshell, and the final thing, by the way, is that when he's out in the forest encountering this thing, they lose sight of it for a bit. They look back, and it's right over the base, firing beams of light down at one of the most sensitive areas in the whole installation.
When this was occurring, Nick, did they get close enough, because they were right on it, to see texture, structure, windows, anything like that?
Well, Jim Peniston certainly did on the first night, and he actually touched this thing, which, in view of subsequent revelations about radiation, was maybe not a good idea. But I mean, at the time, his feeling was that he just had to document this. He had seen, from his perspective, he'd seen John Burroughs either get struck by a beam of light or sort of even go into the light. It's not clear. And he, at one point, thought that John Burroughs was a casualty. And he was thinking, Jim Peniston was thinking, I might not come back from this, so I need to document this so that, you know, people will know what's happened here. So he shot off the whole roll of film. He made sketches in his police notebook, and he touched it, yes. And he said it really was like nothing on Earth. I mean, this thing had none of the things that any conventional aircraft would have, no fuselage, no tail, no wings, no windows. It did have these strange markings, but it didn't say USAF. And Jim, by the way, was incredibly familiar and knowledgeable about different aircraft types, both American, British, Soviet, Warsaw Pact, you name it, he knew it. And this was like nothing he'd ever seen before.
Truly a bizarre case, an incredible case. When you first started looking at this, now you got on the desk from 85 to 2006, and this happened, of course, 5 years before you got there. How did you become aware of it, Nick?
Well, I was actually in the Ministry of Defense, like you say, from 85 to 2006. My time on the UFO project was 91 to 94. I did many other things in my 21-year Ministry of Defense career and ended up in security. To kind of, again, cut a long story short, when I joined the UFO project in 1991, it was clear from me, from looking at the files, that this was the most important and compelling and intriguing and potentially disturbing case that we had on our files. And we had about 12,000 cases, by the way, over the years. So, and this was very much top of the pile. And I decided to launch a cold case review in this because I knew, I soon found out that the original investigation had either been mishandled or it had been kind of sabotaged somehow. I wasn't exactly sure. And I did this cold case review, and that's how I kind of got drawn into this.
Okay, so with all this, let's talk a little bit about Burroughs and Peniston. You work with them, you collaborated with them on writing Encounter in the Rendlesham Forest. Were they ever told, keep quiet, don't say anything like that?
Oh, well, I mean, over the years, I mean, well, but to start off with, immediately after the event, both they and several other witnesses were certainly subject to a number of, should we say, fairly aggressive debriefings. And it's been variously alleged that there were threats and drugs and hypnosis used in all of this. Now, I don't think they were specifically told to keep quiet about this, but in a sense, maybe, I don't know, memories have been pretty scrambled by this over the years anyway. And I mean, just to make it clear, this is not hearsay. This is a direct statement from Colonel Holt, who, of course, was deputy base commander. And I mean, he has actually written about this. He said, Office of Special Investigations operatives harshly interrogated five young airmen, some of them in shock at the time, who were key witnesses. And he went on to say, drugs such as sodium pentothal, often called truth serum, when used with some form of brainwashing or hypnosis, were administered during these interrogations, and the whole thing has had a damaging and lasting effect on the men involved. I mean, this is an extraordinary on-the-record statement from the deputy base commander, so I just wanted to make it clear, this isn't just people running around making claims.
Did you need to get clearance on this book once you wrote it?
Yes. Because of my 21 years in government service, and because both John Burroughs and Jim Peniston, of course, served their country with distinction in a number of different theaters of operation, not all of which can be revealed even now. But suffice to say that they've certainly had top secret clearances. They've operated in places like Iraq and elsewhere. So because of their military service and my government background, we had to submit a manuscript of this book for security clearance, not just to the American government, but the British government. I'm not sure that UFO books generally have to go through this kind of procedure at all, but certainly to have this double whammy, as it were, of both the American and the British government needing to see this in advance and needing to clear it is, I think, without precedent in this field.
Nick, I'm going to have Linda Moulton Howe join us at the half-hour break because of the work that she has done, and you know her well. I'd like her to participate in the discussion with you.
Yes, that's great. As you say, she's really one of the great heroes of this story over the years.
So what happened to the UFO at the end of the 3 days? Never came back, took off? What happened?
Well, it never came back to Rendlesham Forest, but of course there was this extraordinary encounter that actually happened really only a matter of hours after this on December 29th, the Cash Landrum case, and some people realize, but many perhaps don't, just how close in time these two extraordinary UFO incidents were. This was the Cash Landrum encounter was Dayton in Texas, and this was a kind of flaming, metallic, diamond-shaped craft which hovered over their car and was so bright and so hot that when the witnesses got out and tried to get back into the car again, the door handle was so hot that one of the women had to use her coat to protect her hand. And of course, the witnesses in this case went on to develop medical symptoms, which doctors said were certainly indicative of radiation poisoning. And this is a very disturbing aspect of the Rendlesham Forest case, too. So we don't really know what the UFO did after it left Rendlesham, but a very similar encounter took place halfway across the world, and one can't help but wonder whether there's a connection here, and I think the radiation is the key to it.
What do you think the UFO was doing in Rendlesham? Why there?
Well, it's an intriguing question. I mean, I think it's difficult for us now, perhaps, to cast our minds back to just how different a world it was in December 1980. Margaret Thatcher had recently come to power in the United Kingdom. Ronald Reagan had won the election, but of course not yet been inaugurated as president. But it was clear that there was going to be a hard line taken with the Soviets that had really not been taken before. In parallel with this, the Polish trade union Solidarity was rising in power and popularity. And some historians say that December 1980 was really the time when World War III could have started, a time of extraordinary tension, maybe second only to the Cuban Missile Crisis. And did the UFO, whatever it was, Was it something to do with this? Was it something to do with the fact that pretty much around this time, historians now looking back, there's huge controversy, but many people say we came within perhaps hours of Armageddon and World War III.
Oh, boy.
Under cover of the Soviet exercise, codenamed Soyuz 1980, but apparently this was to have been the invasion of Poland, and apparently the ailing Soviet Premier, Leonid Brezhnev, had said to General Jaruzelski, if you don't stamp down on solidarity and stop these guys, we'll do it for you. And apparently, pretty much at the time of the Rendlesham Forest incident was when this was all going to unfold. Is there a connection? I don't know. But I was taught at the MOD never to believe in coincidences.
No, and I never have either. What exactly, Nick, is the Rendlesham Code?
Well, this is one of the most controversial parts, not just of the Rendlesham story, but arguably, I think, of ufology today. When Jim Peniston touched the UFO on the first night, what he kept to himself for decades was that a kind of almost electric shock went through his body, and he received what he has sometimes now described as a telepathic download of ones and zeros. And at the time, this didn't manifest itself, but when he got back to his home after this incident, a couple of days later, as if under a compulsion, he reached for his police notebook and he wrote down 16 pages of ones and zeros. And he subsequently put that aside for nearly 30 years until it emerged almost by accident when he was shooting a TV documentary and they wanted to look at what he got in his police notebook about the sketch of the UFO and these strange hieroglyphs on the side. And someone noticed these ones and zeros and said, what's that? And Jim said, oh, it's the kind of code that I got when I touched the craft. And it's like, Jim, what the heck is this? And, of course, all sorts of people have now tried to decode the Rendlesham message, whatever you call it. Some people think it's coordinates that tally with various, I suppose you'd call them power sites, sites of great significance to ancient civilizations, the Great Pyramid at Giza, the Nazca lines in Peru, the portal at the Temple of Apollo in Naxos, Greece, Sedona, Arizona, and High Brazil, this mythical, or maybe not, who knows, lost island. It's sometimes been called the Celtic Atlantis. So this string of coordinates, but also some words too, exploration of humanity, continuous for planetary advance, origin year 8100, eyes of your eyes. I mean, is this some sort of New Age holiday wish list, or is it something more deep and profound? A lot of people are delving into the code. I mean, one of the things in our book, Encounter in Rendlesham Forest, for the first time, we produce all 16 pages of the binary code. And, of course, all sorts of experts are working on this as we speak, trying to come up with explanations of what this could be and what it means and how we should respond, maybe.
All right. Well, you keep following up. Nick, we're going to come back in a moment, talk more with you on this. And then next hour, we'll take phone calls with Nick Pope as we talk about Encounter in Rendlesham Forest. And welcome back to Coast Encounter in Rendlesham Forest. Nick Pope, along with John Burroughs and Jim Peniston, as they put this incredible story together. Linda Moulton Howe, of course, is our investigative reporter here on Coast to Coast AM. And she, as Nick has just pointed out, been one of the top investigators of this incredible case. Who would do this better justice than Linda? So I wanted her to join us this half hour and talk with Nick about this case and shed her own thoughts on it as well. Linda, welcome back.
Well, thanks, George, and hi, Nick.
Hey, Linda, good to hear from you.
Well,
Linda,
you know,
I'm going to let you...
One of the things, and Nick can jump in, but I think that there has been a significant development just in this year in 2014 that, to put it a little bit in perspective, remember it was 5 years ago on June 25th, 2009, that the once deputy base commander at RAF Bentwaters Woodbridge released this press statement that said, quote, "I wish to make it perfectly clear that the UFOs that I saw were structured machines moving under intelligent control and operating beyond the realm of anything I have ever seen before or since. I believe the objects that I saw at close quarter were extraterrestrial in origin, and that the security services of both the United States and England were and have been complicit in trying to subvert the significance of what occurred at Rendlesham by use of well-practiced methods of disinformation." Close quote. Charles Holt, colonel, who was deputy base commander at RAF Bentwaters December 26 to 28, 1980, when for 72 hours there were all kinds of lights and beams and activity in which John Burroughs and Jim Peniston were involved on the first night after midnight of December 26th, the early morning, and then John Burroughs was also involved two nights later on December 28th. And what has transpired just in recently has been, it was out or first published in 2000, and Nick might have talked about this. This is the from the MOD in England, the Unidentified Aerial Phenomena in the UK Air Defense Region. It's an executive summary of scientific and technical information put out as a memorandum and a secret, top secret, in 2000. Then it was unclassified very quietly without many people knowing. And John Burroughs and I and Nick and others saw this some time ago. And just to give you an indication of why this is important, and John Burroughs thinks it is so important that he released his own press release just a few weeks ago concerning this. And this is coming out of the UK MOD, having to do with scientific and technical information under the heading Potential Mental Effects on Humans. And what they are talking about, George and Nick, is the release of, I'm going to say, fields or frequencies from what the UK always calls UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena, as opposed to the old acronym in the United States, UFOs, unidentified flying objects. So UAPs and UFOs are essentially the same, but this is more technical, and they're using UAP, and they're talking about fields, various kinds of emanations of radiation from unidentified aerial phenomena. And here is the vital paragraph in this UK document. Quote, "The well-reported Rendlesham Forest Bentwaters event is an example where it might be postulated that several observers were probably exposed to UAP radiation for longer than normal UAP sighting periods. It is clear that the recipients of these effects are not aware that their behavior perception of what they are observing is being modified." And then going to paragraph 15, "It is concluded, therefore, that if some UAPs, as is believed and correlated by actual reports with collateral effects, for example, on car electrical equipment," meaning it stops car electrical equipment, "that UAPs produce EM, that's electromagnetic radiation, then there is a high probability that they can affect the human brain. Now, in this case, as John Burroughs knows so well, he has never been able to remember the details after that big bright flash of light that Jim Peniston does remember and walked around the glassy wedge-shaped object that seemed to emerge out of the blast of light and dragged his fingers across this black glassy surface of this wedge-shaped craft. And it was in the process of his fingers coming in touch with the symbols, according to Sergeant Peniston, that he then suddenly had a download in his mind, brain, of zeros and ones and telepathic thoughts that boiled down, this is Jim Peniston's bottom line, that this was some sort of a time machine, that it is related to a desperation of something far in the future that has the ability to come back in time to the 20th and 21st centuries to harvest genetic material to use as band-aids where they are up against some sort of an extinction level. And in this process of coming back in time to collect genetic material, that this was what was ongoing in Rendlesham Forest at that night of December 26th, 27th, and 28th, 1980. That sort of summarizes what I have come to think are the important parts of what I have investigated so far with Jim Peniston and John Burroughs, and that I think, Nick, I'm going to throw this to you in this regard, that the big thing about Bentwaters is the absence of material that we keep getting tantalizing statements from people that the NSA took over the investigation within 24 hours. Colonel Hall told me the NSA has a huge stack of files on RAF Bentwaters that nobody has seen. And in the Ministry of Defense's own alleged release, where they were supposed to be releasing files in on March 3rd, 2011, and the BBC had its own staff go through what was released from the MOD, and they reported on television and at their website on March 4th, 2011, quote, intelligence papers on the Rendlesham incident have gone missing. Officials found a huge gap where defense intelligence files should have been. That is the story of Bentwaters for 35 years, that all of this happened. Many people were affected. A government agency or two or three or a dozen took over and made sure that the public and the media would never get the details. And yet, today in 2014, I think that the summary I gave you is getting close to a possible truth, and that we may, through Bentwaters, decade by decade, keep leveraging open more truth about this strange, as the British say, unidentified aerial phenomena, the UAPs.
What'd you think of that, Nick?
Well, I think Linda's just given a really excellent summary of some of the key points of all this. I'd like to maybe just add a few very brief comments, which I think will supplement what Linda has just kind of briefed listeners on. Firstly, one of the most interesting documents that we produce in the book is what looks like a quite innocuous little internal Ministry of Defense memo dated February 16, 1981. And it reveals almost casually in the final sentence or two that shortly after the incident, General Gabriel visited the base, was briefed on the incident, and took various items pertaining to the investigation back to his headquarters in Germany. Now, what's interesting about that is that General Gabriel was Commander-in-Chief, United States Air Force in Europe. So just really days after the Rendlesham Forest incident, the most senior United States Air Force general in Europe visits the base, is briefed on this, and takes items away, and the trail goes cold. What's particularly fascinating about that, of course, is that officially the American government isn't supposed to be even interested in this anymore, is it? You know, the public position, you know, wait a minute, the public position is that in 1969, Project Blue Book was closed, we're not interested, we don't investigate. Well, if that's true, why on earth is the senior U.S. Air Force general in Europe coming in to be briefed? Now, Linda quoted a very important paragraph from what's colloquially known as Project Condyne's final report, this intelligence study into UFOs. But there's another bit which I think will maybe put some flesh on the bones as to why the secrecy, why the government interest in this. And it's not something that, you know, a lot of listeners will be comfortable with, but I'm afraid the answer is weaponization. I mean, this is, you know, this is the Ministry of Defense looking at this. It is all about weaponization and power and authority and things. And there's a paragraph which talks about Soviet interest in the UFO phenomena. And then it goes on to talk about potential military purposes, and it talks about, it uses the phrase novel military applications. It talks about very high power energy generation and radio frequency weapons. I mean, effectively, we are talking directed energy weapons here. This is the reason why governments are interested in this. And sorry for all the new age people listening, but it's because some people, you know, it's the old saying from, I think, the movie The Medusa Touch. We find out what powers the sun and we make a bomb out of it.
Well, I understand that what you just described is definitely an important facet of all of this, Nick. But I think that the extraterrestrial biological entity aspect of the phenomena has dominated the United States and England government insiders since World War II, because they were dealing with something they didn't understand, and probably to this day, not all the answers are there. But it to address one of the things you brought up that underscores how the governments were trying so hard to keep the public and the media at a long arm's length distance from everything that they were exposed to and learning, is the long three-day interview that I did back in 1998 down in the Florida area with the man who at the citizens' hearing a year ago was introduced as anonymous. I knew him by his real name, and he asked me to call him Cooper, K-E-W-P-E-R, so that's what I'm going to refer to him tonight. And Cooper was working in a southeastern military base teaching in the cryptography area, but he was getting a paycheck from the Central Intelligence Agency in Langley. His boss was CIA Langley, and they were a top-secret classified group analyzing photographs, 16-millimeter film, all sorts of things related to extraterrestrial biological entities and their technologies. And interestingly, the institution or agency that was directing the material from the CIA and other agencies was going through Fort Belvoir, Virginia. This was the real classified Project Blue Book, he explained. And that's what they called it, Project Blue Book. To completely muddy the waters and confuse the situation forever, they, in collaboration with the Air Force, put out a very phony, meant to be phony, never to be real, Project Blue Book of the same name this is the one that got out into the newspapers and radio and was so sarcastic about the phenomena. This is the Project Blue Book that was disbanded in 1969 with a kind of theatricality. We have concluded that there is nothing here. Go away. And meanwhile, the real Project Blue Book through Fort Belvoir, CIA, and other agencies was ongoing and active, and is to this day. And that we are in the Bentwaters, I think the confluence between knowing that there were nuclear missiles under both the England and the U.S. side, Bentwaters and Woodbridge, knowing that there was great interest in any kind of a energy beam weapon, but also somebody there from Gabriel on to, let's say, the MJ-12 group, that the idea that they were dealing with something that was did not have pilots in it, but was some sort of self-activated machine that came out of a blast of light in the forest, must certainly have gotten the National Security Agency and CIA's attention. And that I think that when Colonel Holt told John Burroughs and me about 3 years ago that he knew for a fact that the NSA took over the investigation of Bentwaters within 24 hours, and after that, no one from Colonel Holt to anyone else could get the details.
Great job there, Linda. And I know you've got to leave. You've got an early morning assignment and a meeting. So thank you for being on the program.
Well,
really
thank you.
It.
This is so important. I hope we can do something like this again.
Absolutely. Nick, this is one of those cases that, of course, gets bigger and bigger and bigger. What happens next? I mean, you've got this incredible book out now. What's next?
Well, I think a couple of things. Firstly, there is the whole business that John Burroughs and Jim Peniston both have a number of health issues which are being taken forward with the VA. Obviously, this is incredibly topical at the moment because of all
the VA scandals,
problems.
Yeah.
Indeed. And the thinking is that, I mean, as Linda quoted, this British intelligence study basically came out and said these people were probably irradiated by this object, whatever it was. And certainly the question then arises, well, Jim and John's health issues, are they directly attributable to that? And in an attempt to find out this, something quite extraordinary emerged in that both Jim and John's medical records seemed to be lodged in a little-known classified section of the VA. And normally this would be the sort of thing that would happen to people that were special forces. But Jim and John weren't special forces. They've done a number of interesting things all around the world. But there should be no reason why their medical records shouldn't be released. And in the
good question.
Well, yeah, and in the appendix of the book, one of the things, you know, Jim and John both testified, as did I, at the citizens' hearing on disclosure. And the former congressional representatives who made up the
they chaired it, yeah.
They were so outraged by the inability of Jim and John to access their medical records that they immediately got one of their staffers together. They got together with Pat Frascogna, who's a lawyer, an attorney who has helped Jim and John with Freedom of Information Act requests. They wrote to the president about this.
Well, let's hope they're successful. Nick, we're going to talk more, plus we'll take phone calls next.